Well, we're at Judges chapter 8 this morning for our lesson. And the first thing we run into is that in the very middle of a wondrous work that God is doing, and something that the other tribes and the other people of Israel could not accomplish on their own, yet due to God's call and God's plan being followed, the enemy is routed now. And it's just a matter of completing the task of overcoming to make sure that there'll be no rising again of the enemy. But the first thing that Gideon runs into is something that's very common, and that is that if people are not really called and if they're not really led of the Lord, they don't understand those who are. And we can see how that this lesson reveals how that the work of the Lord was unrecognized and it was unaccepted by all of those who did not understand and have respect for the calling that God gave to Gideon. And of course, there are circumstantial reasons that they had for that, but if they would have had a spiritual take on the whole thing, why, they would have a totally different view about it. So we have the unjust accusations now being made against Gideon, and it tells us in verse 1 that the men of Ephraim said unto him, "Why hast thou served us thus?" Now I want you to just notice the emphasis, what their concern is. It's us. It's us. It's not God. It's not God's campaign, but us. So, why hast thou served us thus, that thou calledest us not, when thou wentest to fight with the Midianites, and they did chide with him sharply? So what's the biggest thing on their mind? Us. Going back to chapter 7, and there in verse 2, the Lord said unto Gideon, "The people that are with thee are too many for me to give the Midianites into thine hand, lest Israel vaunt themselves against me, saying, Mine own hand has saved me." So this was the very mindset that God said, I can't use in the army, because their focus will be on themselves. It'll be on what they are, what they can do, and they will take the credit for it. So that's where the people of Ephraim are, and you can understand why that God said, I can't use those who might have that attitude. And yet when you trace it back, where does this come from? Well, it came from their pride, it came from their envy, and it came from a lack of being surrendered to know God's will, and they were certainly not in communion with God in the attitude that they took. On Gideon's end of it, he had done all that he could do to fulfill God's call and deliver Israel. Plus, back in the 24th verse of chapter 7, he had sent messengers throughout all Mount Ephraim and said, come, you know, join the campaign. Now, he did not overstep God's boundaries because he had already routed the enemy in with his 300 company. And now it was just a matter of completing the task of, you might say, weakening and eliminating now the rest of the armies. So what more could he have done? God told him what to do. He did what God told him to do. And as soon as that part of the campaign was carried out, then he invited them to come and join in the campaign. But that wasn't preeminent enough for them. They wanted something more. It's kind of like that. I know when people are just not quite settled like they need to be, sometimes they will acknowledge something as, yeah, that was good, but it would have been so much better if it had been done this way. And so that's a pattern that can come from the flesh. And so there's always that, you know, that thought of man about something more preeminent for himself. And so they expected Gideon to do that which would be in honor of them and would give them credit, would exalt them. They did not respect the fact that he was following God's will with a true heart. That's not what they were looking at. And they did not recognize the fact that Gideon had not designed any of this. This was God's plan. That didn't even interest their thinking at all. All they were thinking about was us and how we feel about this. Gideon, I think, now in his response, he had every right to be very sharp with these people. He had every right to really bring the hammer down on them. But they're in the middle of a battle. They're in the middle of a war that needs to be carried out to its full extent. And if he would have tried at this point in time to subdue the men of Ephraim, that wouldn't have worked. I mean, that would have been a total distraction from the war campaign. And I'm sure that it would not have made him feel very good either in having to try to justify God's plan. But so what he does is use wisdom. He applies wisdom to the situation. In verse 2, he said unto them, "What have I done now in comparison of you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the vintage of Abiezer?" So he first of all says, well, you guys are way ahead of me. Your place, your heritage, everything you've got is way ahead of me. And so he said, "God hath delivered into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb, and Zeb. And what was I able to do in comparison of you?" Then their anger was abated toward him when he had said that. So he did what he had to do at this time, considering what was more important. It was more important to keep the army together than it was to fight his own battle at this time. There are some things that we are better off leaving them in God's hands. And so rather than Gideon come to his defense and get all upset because people didn't understand what he was doing, he thought, well, now what needs to be done here to where we can go ahead with this campaign against the enemy? And that is keep the army together. Keep together. So he knew he could not satisfy those who respected not his calling just by saying that this is the way God said it should be done. He knew that would not satisfy them. So he did what he had to do to bring unity to the army, to calm the storm, and to get everybody focused again on what the real issue was, and that was fighting the enemy. So I think that there are times like that, that you cannot just contend for every detail. You cannot think that self-defense is the best way to go, but seeing what the cause is and seeing what the overall point is and applying wisdom to that, that can bring a great resolution and let the details be worked out by God later on, because we know God's able to bring things to the level that they need to be on. So moving on from that, we now have Gideon. He came to Jordan and passed over. He and the 300 men that were with him faint, yet pursuing them. So they started out, 301 men, counting Gideon. They had trumpets, they had pitchers, they had lamps. And that's what they went to the battle with. But now they are pursuing with the enemy, are pursuing the enemy. And I'm sure that they were able to gather enough weapons to supply themselves from the number of people that had already fallen in battle, as you see back in chapter 7 and verse 22, that the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow. So there was enough fallen soldiers, just in case it enters in your mind, that they just started out with the trumpets and the pitchers and the lamps. I'm sure right now They have swords that they can go forth and fight. But they're faint, but they're not giving up. They're not quitting. They are still moving on. And of course, this is what Christ said, that you have to embrace this mindset in his work, he that endureth unto the end. And the end was not yet. So Gideon was still enduring. And think about, again, where Gideon's at. God called him, God told him what to do, and God assured him of a victory. They've already seen a major victory. But when Gideon comes to the men of Succoth, and these are of the tribe of Gad, they are Israelites, they should have been for the cause of Israel's deliverance. They should have been wanting to know what God's plan was. They should have respected God's way of doing things here. But instead, when Gideon says, we need some food because we're hungry, in verse 5, and he said, I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, kings of Midian. And the princes of Succoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna now in thine hand that we should give bread unto thine army? Well, this is not an uncommon mindset, but rather than see it through the eyes of God's calling and God's presence and God's promises, they're looking at it from the circumstantial aspect. And they're saying, well, you really haven't won the war yet. And therefore, since you really haven't won the war yet, you might not win the war. And if you don't win the war and we are in support of you, that's going to put us in jeopardy. And we don't want to be in jeopardy. So we're not going to give you food. We're not going to help you out. So they were completely void of all consideration. God's calling, God's working, what God had already done and what God had promised. That was not in the picture at all. It was just looking at it from their own point of view as to how things would size up in their own estimation rather than according to God's promise. Gideon said in verse 7, therefore when the Lord hath, in other words, it's not a question in my mind what's going to happen because God has promised. When the Lord hath delivered Zeba and Zalmunna into mine hand, then I will tear your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. So then he moves on to Penuel, which is also of the tribe of Gad, and spake unto them. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Succoth had answered him. And he spake also unto the men of Penuel, saying, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. So it was not a good thing for them to take that attitude, that they were going to just be standoffish and not be a part of it because they didn't want to jeopardize themselves in any way with what might happen if Gideon did not succeed. So when you think about this no vote of confidence on their part, Gideon, however, was operating on the truth and the promises of God. To them, that didn't mean anything. The truth and the promises of God is not what they were looking at. They were looking at something else. So this initial success that God had given by the hand of God did not really mean anything to them. They considered that the ultimate triumph would be decided by men and whatever that would happen in that area by the forces of men is what they thought the ultimate triumph would happen from. And so often, just think about that for a moment. It's easy for us to sometimes displace God's promise and look at something from a circumstantial point of view. And that's what they were doing. They were not looking at the outcome based on God's promise. They were looking at it based on circumstantial factors that they could calculate would possibly work out this way. There was no real allegiance to the truth on their part. They were just wanting to have the favor of men when the time came. That's what they were. They were going to rely upon having the favor of man rather than stand with God. And of course, that is a very shaky ground to be on. Gideon considers their position to be a crime. He does not consider it to be one that should be acknowledged and accepted, but that anybody who won't stand with God's plan and God's purpose, that they are committing a terrible sin. And this is something that is going to come back on them. So he was scorned by people who had strength on their own part, but they did not know God's call and God's plan, and they didn't want to lose favor with the world, so they were not willing to help Gideon out. I think when you consider the belief-unbelief picture here, they were definitely were in the unbelief picture. And unbelief, that the greatest confidence that unbelief has is getting the favor of men. That's where the confidence of unbelievers is. Having the favor of men, having the favor of the world, well, they think as long as they have that, they're safe. Everything's going to work out right for them. And so that's what they were doing. They, of course, had staked their claim now on trying to assure that they would be looked upon favorably by men. They were skeptical about God's way for a victory. To them, it was too risky. Again, we have circumstances, we have the favor of the world, and then we have God's plan, and we have God's promise. But they looked at it and says, well, you know, it's too risky for us to follow what God would want, or what you say God is doing. So they had feelings about this. Their own feelings were causing them to keep aloof or to stay back from Gideon's campaign. They were not at all rooted in it. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 13, Christ said, every plant is not planted of my heavenly Father shall be rooted up. They weren't rooted. 1 John chapter 2 and verse 19 says that they went out from us because they were not of us. If they had been of us, they would have continued with us. So we can definitely draw a line on a lot of things as to what people's response is based on following God's plan and God's will, where their confidence rests. So in verse 9, Gideon said, there's going to be a harvest for what you have done. Every choice that we make, there is a harvest for it. And Christ said in Matthew 12:30 that he that is not with me is against me. So moving on from that now, that has all been, you might say, this is what's going to happen now. And so Zeba and Zalmunna in verse 10 were in Karkor, their hosts with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of all the host of the children of the east, for there fell 120,000 men that drew the sword. So the army has been tremendously reduced now, but still you have 300 men against 15,000 men. So that definitely doesn't look like something that one would want to put their confidence in the flesh and be on Gideon's side, unless you had faith in God to do it. So they had the they were secure in their numbers. They were secure by human estimation. But in verse 11, it says that Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in the tents on the east of Noba and Jokbeha, and smote the host, for the host was secure. And when Zebah and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zebah and Zalmunna, and discomfited the host. So he caught them by surprise. They had no idea that anything like this could happen, that these 300 men could, you know, just upset their apple cart and defeat them. And so again, they had their security, and their whole army is discomfited. That is, it is now destroyed as far as being a force of opposition. They were neutralized. Well, Gideon and his men still hadn't been to Frisch's yet. They still were hungry. And how were they able to go on? They were being sustained by God's grace. And that's something to keep in mind. When there's nothing else, there's always God. And if we're doing his work, we are assured that he'll be with us. So they did not get their sustenance from men, but rather the grace of God sustained them. Now in verse 13 it says that Gideon the son of Joash returned from battle before the sun was up. So this was not a lengthy thing. God not only sustained them, but he enabled them. And he's now coming back to do what he said he would do to those who would not join the army and join the campaign. Now, before we read what he did what he said he was going to do, but I want to go back to the fifth chapter of Judges, and there in verse 23, when Barak was along with Deborah, and they were doing their work of giving victory to Israel, and there were some people of Israel that would not join in the campaign. So in Judges 5:23, here's what the pronunciation was for that. Curse ye Meroz, and said the angel of the Lord, curse ye bitterly the inhabitants thereof, because they came not to the help of the Lord, to the help of the Lord against the mighty. So there is a lot to be said about people who won't take their part. And, you know, Hebrews chapter 2 and verse 3 says, how shall we escape if we neglect? How shall we escape if we neglect? James 4:17 says, if we know and do not, it is sin. So if it's God's work, there's only one thing that needs to be done, and that is be a part of it. Join it by faith. Don't neglect it. And don't have standoffish attitudes about it. No work for God can ever be accomplished with a standoffish attitude. I'm just going to wait and see. That will never get anything done for the Lord at all. But we know that oftentimes there is double-mindedness. Sometimes people would like to see something done, but they don't think that it can be done. They're doubtful that it can be done. And so that's not a good thing. God says that a double-minded person is unstable in all their ways. So Gideon considered it to be an unforgivable position that they had, and that there was no justification for it. So the point is, it's serious not to respect the Lord's plan and those who are abiding in his calling, no matter how insignificant it may appear to be in the eyes of men. And Gideon and 300 men and trumpets and pitchers certainly considered, was looked upon as being insufficient in view of over 100,000 army going up against them. So we've got to be willing to stand up to the opposition to God's work. Sometimes people don't want to get involved. I know oftentimes when a church has to take its stand on some issue in some person's life, it's like Paul had to write to the church at Corinth in 1 Corinthians chapter 5 and challenge them, because they were just letting it slide rather than to deal with it. And he told them they was going to have to take their stand, because a little leaven would leaven a whole lump. And so we've got to be willing to take our stand with God rather than just stand on the sideline and let everything slide. So in verse 14 now, it says that Gideon caught a young man of the men of Succoth and inquired of him, and he described unto him the princes of Succoth, the elders thereof, even 77 men. So 77 men. He came unto the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto the men that are weary? And he took the elders of the city and the thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth. And he beat down the tower of Penuel and slew the men of the city. Well, what this would mean going forward now, here is a chapter that has been written of what happens to people that don't join up with the Lord's work. So that would not change anything for them necessarily, the men of Succoth or the men of Penuel, but it would definitely have an impact on the thinking of the future thoughts that people might have about the Lord's work. And there's a whole lot of times that there are things that you have to do that is really not going to remedy anything, but they have to be done to send a message and to, you might say, drive a stake in the ground and to establish where the lines need to be drawn. So that's what Gideon's doing. He's establishing where the lines need to be drawn, because sometimes, you know, it's easy to kind of be, well, I'm not sure. And then when you have something happen like this, okay, you know, so this would sort of give people some clarity going forward from here. That's much in the category of punishing crime. There, of course, is in our day and time a lot of confusion about that. But punishing crime is not necessarily going to reverse the crime, but it will send a message even going forward. It'll change the attitudes of people about committing crime. And if that's not there, then people are just going to get bold in committing more crime. So in verse 18, then said he unto Zebah and Zalmunna, what manner of men were they whom ye slew at Tabor? And they answered, as thou art, so were they. Each one resembled the children of a king. And he said, they were my brethren, even the sons of my mother. As the Lord liveth, if ye had saved them alive, I would not slay you. And he said unto Jether, his firstborn, up and slay them. But the youth drew not his sword, for he feared, because he was yet a youth. Then Zebah and Zalmunna said, rise thou and fall upon us, for as a man is, so is his strength. And Gideon arose and slew Zebah and Zalmunna, and took away the ornaments that were on their camels' necks. Well, Revelation 13:10 says, those who have showed no mercy will receive no mercy. So these were Gideon's family that they had killed. And so Gideon said, well, you know, this is retribution now. And if you had not killed my family, then I would have saved you alive. But it was unnecessary for them to do that. So they're now going to have to pay the price. But you notice down in verse 21, their attitude was, as a man is, so is his strength. You kill us. Defiance. Defiant right unto the very end. Gideon's power was evidently not something that was visible, either in his stature or in his movements, because his victory had been God-given. And I think their attitude is, you can't do this. You know, you're just all mouth. And so put your sword where your mouth is here, big boy. Well, he did. And so they died. So a lot of times when it comes to Christianity and Christ, a lot of people don't have respect for its power. They think that it's, you know, just a bunch of old softies and a bunch of old women, and There's nothing really there of power. But when it comes to Christ and the work of the Lord, there's no greater power. And it needs to have a lot of respect, and people need to regard it as being of God. Well, the devil wants to affect the best, or the, let's say, the last chapter of our lives. Gideon had done a great work for God, and now we see how things begin to settle down after the war is over. And so it says that the men of Israel said unto Gideon, "Rule thou over us, both thou and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian." Now that would be a normal response in a political world, to where that they would say, you know, this guy has really served us well. He's been our General Eisenhower, so let's make him our president. And they said, we want you to be our leader, our ruler, and then after you, your sons also. Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you. The Lord shall rule over you. And Gideon's very clear on the fact that the victory that he had was God-given. And it wasn't because that he himself had some special talent to take care of a nation himself. He said, I'm not the guy that can take care of this nation. I'm not the one that you're to look to. The Lord is to be your king. The Lord is to be your ruler. So he's rightly dividing the authority of God. This would have been a mighty temptation if Gideon would have been a man who was only interested in Gideon. He could have really began to, his wheels began to spin about what a place he could have. But he said, no, we've got to respect spiritual things. Here is a thought to go with that. Not every opportunity is of God. The devil will tempt us in ways that we might think is God's blessing. There was a church, and this is a real story, and so a new pastor went to it, and the first thing he did was look up the number of people who were on the church roll that were not coming to church. And he started visiting and inquiring and trying to help them and see what he could do. He came across a couple, a young couple, and they were friendly with him and talked with him. And they both had big jobs, making good money, and no time to come to church. So they were so occupied with all of their busyness in life that they couldn't come to church. And then they started talking about the Lord's blessing. And he told him, he said, no, you got it backwards. Anything that's keeping you from serving God is not really the Lord's blessing. It's robbing you of what you could have and what you need to have. When I was still working in Cincinnati, and this is back in November of 67, there was a consolidation of our company with some other companies, and we had a model that was working well. Our company was making money. And so this other group wanted us to incorporate our methods into their business. And I was controller, which was the business financial officer in the company. And so the president called me in and told me, he said, this is what's happening. You can write your ticket. And you have great opportunity in front of you financially. And I thought, that's weird. You know, all of a sudden this is coming up. Well, here came Faith Baptist Church Mission. January, just about a month or so after that. And then it hit me. All right, here is something the devil's placing before me that I've got a great future, supposedly, financially ahead of me. That's supposed to distract me from what God would want me to do. And that's the way it works. Many, many times there will be such a great thing open up for you that you think, boy, that's where God wants me to go. That's an opportunity. But not every opportunity is God-given. We have to be able to sort that out. When The king of Sodom offered Abraham all the goods and everything from Sodom. Abraham said, I won't take a thread or a shoe latchet from you, because he said, I want God to be the one that I'm looking to for my sustenance. So anyway, you can find here that Gideon had this tremendous opportunity. He said, no, this is not of God. This is not something that God would want me to do. And if you're looking to me instead of looking to God, you're making a mistake. Don't do that. And look to the Lord. And so another thing he put, neither shall my son rule over you. So if they had respect for Gideon, that would resonate with them in the future. But in chapter 9, that did not stick with them. And they chose one of Gideon's worst sons to be their king, and it resulted in a civil war and a lot of tragedy. We will see that in our future study. Then in verse 24 through 27, Gideon is beholden to God and what all God has done. So he, of his own thinking, what can I do? What can I do now to do something to, kind of memorialize my appreciation for God and kind of send a message to people that we should be looking to God? And it came to him to make a golden ephod. Now, an ephod was a priestly garment. So in his mind, we'll make this golden ephod. Everybody will be reminded of the great victory that God gave us over the Midianites. And everybody will, focus on God now when they look at this ephod. Well, that's not the way it turned out. It's kind of like the brazen serpent that was raised up. Eventually, people began to think that had some special significance itself, and they were looking to the brazen serpent beyond the incident it was really designed for, as if it had some spiritual power. So anyway, you will find in the verse 27, all Israel went thither a whoring after it, meaning that now they've got something that they're looking to, like the rosary, the beads, and the images out in the yards that people have. So they began to think that this has some spiritual significance to it. And so they began to, their attention, the ephod, we'll give respect to the ephod. We'll look to the ephod as having some spiritual significance. And it became a stumbling block to them. It got them in the wrong frame of mind. There's a lesson to be learned here. And that is, it does not matter what our intentions are. We've got to keep things in line with God's plan. Gideon was a good man of God. So it does not matter who is leading it. If something is not God's plan, it can be a good leader, it can be with good intention, but if it's not God's plan, it will eventually go in the wrong direction. I know that's how conventionalism got started. And the idea was that churches can join together and be a greater force for the Lord's work. Well, conventionalism eventually turned to modernism, and men got in control of it, and it got away from the intent that it had originally, and became more of a compromise than it was for a direct work of God. Well, in verse 28, all the time that followed this victory, all the days of Gideon, Israel had peace. And so you can see the great contribution that Gideon made to his country. He was also a very humble man in the sense that he dwelt in his own house. He did not try to, build him a castle somewhere, but he was just one of the people and he dwelt among the people. But there was this problem of multiple wives in verse 30 and 31. And he had 70 sons. So I'm sure that at that point in time, that was something that was done in the Old Testament time. It was not God's plan, but people did it. They had multiple wives. I'm sure at that time it was a matter of pride to have that many sons, 70 sons. But you get into chapter 9 and you'll find all of them but one, or let's say most of them, were killed. They died a horrible death. So that, again, shows us that things that look good in the ultimate end may not necessarily be good. So Israel, Gideon dies a good old age. Verse 32, had a good life, had accomplished a lot. But in verse 33, as soon as he was dead, the children of Israel go right back again to their idol worship. They remember not the Lord, which had delivered them out of the hands of all their enemies on every side. Neither showed they kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, namely Gideon, according to all the goodness which he had showed unto Israel. In other words, just forgot him. That's all something in the past now. This is a pattern that is adopted over and over again. Like Ronald Reagan said, a nation can lose its freedom in one generation. A church can lose its soundness in one generation. So Israel, in one generation, lost their stand with God. And this is a preface to the next chapter. We will see what happened as a result of these wayward things. And of course, forgetting God resulted in Israel moving from a triumphant state unto a tyrant state. A tyrant took over and really ravaged the nation. But the whole point is, Gideon's labor was not in vain. So anything we do for the Lord, well, that's something that's going to stand forever.